Ladies and gentlemen, this is your captain speaking. Please make sure your seatbelt is securely fastened, your tray table is in an upright and locked position, and that you are ready to get weird and think different. Please prepare for takeoff. Today is Wednesday. It is August the 4th. We're back with another episode of Destination Different. I'm back home. I'm back in Boston. If you didn't tune into the show last week, I mentioned that I was in the midst of a 13-day road trip of the southern United States. So I went from Boston to Phoenix, from Phoenix to Austin, from Austin to Houston, from Houston to Vegas, and finally, as of yesterday, I have returned home from Vegas to Boston, richer than I was when I entered Vegas, I might add. I had some minor success in the world of sports gambling. Never really gambled, never been much of my thing, but to leave Vegas up money, I think is a good sign. And again, as I mentioned on last week's show, you know, part of my job, I work in the alcohol space, is going into these different locations and doing what they call market visits. So I visited grocery stores and convenience stores and liquor stores and bars to see how our products are showing up in these different areas of the country, because a bar in Phoenix looks drastically different than a bar in my hometown of Boston, or a convenience store in Houston, Texas looks drastically different than a convenience store that's inside of a resort in Vegas. And so that was also part of my experience, was getting the chance to go out and see how our drinks, how our marketing, how our work is showing up in these different areas. And it could not have been a more perfect transition for me to come back into this week's guest, because my guest on this week's show is also in the beverage space. His name is Josh Belinsky, and he is one of the co-founders of Slate Milk. And so Slate Milk is a low sugar, now no sugar, I guess, no added sugar, high protein, lactose-free chocolate milk product. And so Josh, along with his co-founder Manny, started Slate back in 2018 and have continued to just really grow this thing and make it into a CPG product that is sought after by, you know, top athletes, by big investors. And so it was fascinating to kind of hear what the non-alcoholic side of the beverage industry is shaking out like, but also just hear his story and how that they have built this product. So Slate, you know, they raised $50,000 in an amazing Kickstarter campaign, and that set off a chain of events that led to them getting on Shark Tank, that led to them taking on other angel investors, that led them getting placement in Whole Foods. And they have taken that momentum and just continued to work tirelessly and build this product to something that is now, you know, really a big player in the CPG space. And so we talked about a little bit of everything on this week's episode. So Josh shared, you know, kind of the founding story and how this thing got its start from an idea to 2 years of work in the making to actually even take it to launch. And then from that launching point, how they, you know, raised capital, how they approached their marketing, how they started to really position themselves amongst, you know, big retailers like Whole Foods and Roche Brothers and a number of others up and down the East Coast. And now as they, you know, continue to develop across the country within e-commerce, they just recently tapped into Amazon as another distribution partner. So it was really just interesting to hear how Josh and his team have built out Slate from a nugget in their heads, where, you know, Josh and Manny both say that they were drinking a lot of chocolate milk as kids because it was a great, you know, recovery vehicle for athletics, and how they continued drinking it through college, but there really wasn't a good, you know, lower sugar, healthier option that was also lactose free. You know, the two of them both developed a lactose intolerance over the years. And so they set out to build a product that was better suited for them. And it just so happened that thousands upon others, you know, were looking for some of the same. So this was an amazing episode. I am very, very excited to introduce you to Josh. He is funny, he is smart, he is charismatic. You can just hear how hard that they have worked to build this product where it is today. So without further ado, I will kick it over to Josh Belinsky on this week's episode of Destination Different. I hope you enjoy. Feel to have Mark Cuban spit out your pride and joy?
Honestly, it was one of the coolest. I mean, obviously in the moment it wasn't great, but I think now it's such a great story to tell. And so, that actually happened, I guess now almost 3 years ago. It's more than 2 years ago. And it was a lab made sample in a package that wasn't even final yet. And so it was a really good arc to our story to say, like, we literally had just an idea, no sales, no manufacturing, nothing. We had a lab made sample from Mark Cuban spinning it out on national television to kind of where we've gotten to within the last kind of 18 months to 2 years since then. We get really excited about, and a lot of the people around us got excited about. So it's definitely bittersweet. As we say, the moment was great for the brand. It was brutal for our egos.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Like, national television, big moment. And yeah. I mean, if nothing else, it will someday, you know, years from now, you'll get to tell your grandkids, like, this is how it all went down. So to back up a little bit, so you know, where does the idea for you come from to make a high protein, low sugar chocolate milk? Like, where is the origin of this nugget of an idea even begin to start?
The story is very, very long, but I think the short answer is that my co-founder and I both grew up in the greater Boston area, did not know each other growing up, but we both were playing a ton of sports and drinking a lot of chocolate milk. And we both at different points in our lives became lactose intolerant, had to switch over to the lactose-free stuff and continue to drink it through college and even post-college. We dabbled with, you know, the protein powders, the Muscle Milk, like those kind of guys. But still didn't make us feel good. And the only thing that really made us feel good, but wasn't that great for us, was chocolate milk. And so separately, even though we both went to Northeastern, we had a lot of mutual friends. We never actually met until after school, where we both were working on separate tech ventures. And through the tech world, we became friends. We talked all the time about potential ideas. We always thought it would be in tech. And then somehow it came up that we both drank lactose-free chocolate milk. And as a joke, we were just literally on a whim, like, what if we started this? And it was not an actually well-formulated idea at all. And we, like, a few nights later, Manny sent me a presentation of pitching me on a very early prototype of what now Slate is. And I was like, there's literally no way I'm doing this with you. And he bullied me for the next 2 weeks, letting me know that I absolutely needed to be his co-founder because we had really good matching skill sets. And we're like, all right, fine, we'll do it nights and weekends and see if this is something that's possible out there. And we got a lot of really good feedback. A lot of people being like, what the hell is wrong with you guys? Nobody drinks milk. Mm-hmm. But a lot of also really encouraging feedback about potential space in the market and potential opportunities. So that was kind of the inception of us starting Slate.
I mean, I don't know if this is what this says about you or Manny, but it only took him 2 weeks to wear you down. So clearly you thought there was something in the idea. It wasn't like this was like 2 years in the making of him trying to sell you on it.
It's very, very true. I don't know either, but I give him credit.
But he got you. I assume you still have that original pitch deck he made for you.
It was called Sweet Victory Drinks, because everybody deserves a little sweet victory. So some of that brand ethos is still part of Slate today. But it is funny. It's literally like a soup can style, all black package. And it's at some point we will share with the world when we actually become successful enough for people to care.
When it starts to, you know, where the transition happened, when did you make the switch to the name of Slate? Was there any other iterations in between there?
We had so many iterations, but like name wise, we started at Sweet Victory and we moved to Slate pretty early on in the process. We never launched, like it was all ideation from Manny and I first deciding to work on this together until actually launching it was a full 2 years. It was very hard to get supply chain and all that kind of stuff up and running. And so I would say maybe the first year of that was Sweet Victory, maybe a little less. But right when we were talking to manufacturers and all that kind of stuff, we had settled on the name Slate.
Okay. I always like to ask, especially in the product world for founders, you know, I've had a couple of people on the show who have created their own thing from nothing.
Yeah.
So for you guys, like, where was that inflection point of, and I guess, how does this come to life? But going from this idea stage of like, sweet victory, it's on a PowerPoint deck, you know, you have this thing that's an idea in your head of what this could be, to actually having the physical thing that you're trying, you're sampling, you're drinking on, like, what, where does that transition point happen that you actually are like, oh, this is like a real tangible thing that I can touch and taste?
So when we first started, we tried to make it ourselves. So we would just buy other products and just mix them together. And we would try buying raw ingredients. And after less than a day, we're like, wow, we can definitely not do this. We're not putting water and sugar and, you know, fruit juice into a blender bottle and mixing it up. It is very complicated stuff, especially working with a product such as ultra filtered milk, not just kind of regular old milk from the cow. So we knew pretty early on that we needed to have expertise from folks in the space. And we looked for R&D partners very early. I think what got us really excited was the first time we ever tried it. Was it the best thing we've ever tasted? No. Was it a real product that was something that we knew could get there? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It was the mouthfeel, the understanding what was potential with this ultra filtered milk base and the combination of chocolate and all that kind of good stuff. That was kind of that moment where we're like, all right, this is something that's doable if we can hone it in a little bit. And that first iteration to now has probably changed 150 times. I don't even know. It's probably more.
Yeah. Like, and this is maybe a silly question, but is it as simple as like, who makes milk on Google? And you're like trying to find people to like help you like bring this to life. Is that simple as this is?
It's not a dumb question. Like, the amount of people that ask us, how do you start a business? It literally is mostly Google. It's a ton of Googling. It's a ton of phone calls. I mean, I think I've told the story before, but when we were trying to figure out how to take the sugar out of milk, we're like, what do you do? Like, do you boil it? Like, how do you take it down? Because milk naturally has 12 grams of sugar in every cup of it. And we just LinkedIn searched dairy expert. And there was a guy that had dairy expert in his LinkedIn with his cell phone number on his page. That to this day, I don't know if he knows who we are, but he gave us like an hour of his time and taught us about ultrafiltration. So sometimes it's just knocking on doors, Googling, calling, emailing. And that's basically what we did for about 2 full years.
To figure out how to bring this thing to life.
Is the
ultra filtration process, that's not like proprietary to Slate. Like, that's something that's used elsewhere as well.
It's been around for a long time. Actually, it's the main way they make cheese and other protein powders. It's Fairlife, which is now owned 100% by Coca-Cola. They also have Core Power. If anybody's seen either of those brands, they also use the ultra filtered milk core right now itself, like as the milk, as the liquid. What you do is you basically separate out the proteins and suffocate it and then spray dry it. And that's how you get whey protein powder or casein powder, because milk is just made of casein and whey. But we just keep it as a liquid together, which is why Slate tastes more like regular milk. You don't have that chalky taste that a lot of protein powders give you, because we haven't put it through all that extra process. So it is more of its raw form. What we do is we take the milk, you put it through a filter, and the filter catches a lot of the lactose sugars and some of the water, which basically just condenses the milk. And that's why it's a little bit thicker than normal milk. Even though it's skim, it gives you a mouthfeel like a 2%. Mm-hmm. And you're getting more protein, but you're having none of the sugar. So to us, we're like, this is game changing. That why isn't all milk this way? Unfortunately, the machinery is expensive. So you do need to work with a group of farms, a co-op, versus, you know, just an individual dairy farm at this point probably couldn't afford that type of machine. But that's why we want to continue to grow with our family farms and continue to add family farms as our brand grows, to enable all of these folks to create what we believe is what's best for humans, which is products with less sugar and more protein.
Okay. So I have two questions coming off of that.
Yeah.
It's, you do this ultrafiltration process, and then are you adding the chocolate element to it? Like, on, you're laying that on top. So you have like a chocolate supplier. You're not like going knocking on Hershey's door and they're like giving you the chocolate, but like, is there a chocolate supplier that's going into this as well?
Exactly. Yep. So we have a milk partner, There are family-owned farms in upstate New York, and they deal with the ultrafiltration as well. We bring that to our manufacturing partner. So milk is just one of the, ultrafiltered milk is one of the ingredients. And then we have a cocoa supplier out of the Netherlands. You know, our cocoa comes from the Netherlands. Dutch cocoa is always highly regarded as a great line of cocoa, and it's all ethically sourced and all that kind of supply chain that's really important to us. And then like our coffee for our espresso comes right from, it's Colombian cold brew coffee. And all the other ingredients that we're using in our product. So we try to keep the ingredients list short with things that people understand what they are, but kind of different suppliers for each that kind of all meet and are blended in a huge blender and then pasteurized into our cans.
Okay. Where is your supply coming? Like, does it all ultimately meet in one warehouse? Like that's somewhere domestically?
The manufacturer is in Western New York or upstate New York. So it's, everything kind of conglomerates there. They fill the cans, they spray a little bit of nitrogen on top of the can, and then they put the lid on it, and they put it in a big pressure cooker, and it cooks the product so that it makes it shelf stable. It gets rid of all the bacteria. And so that's why like a Starbucks drink, you can just buy it off the shelf. So there's no chemicals in our products, nothing. It's shelf stable because we're literally just cooking it. And it's what any other coffee or protein shake that's in a, most of them in plastic bottles and all of them that are in aluminum cans due to their product. And then now our products, you know, don't have to be refrigerated and they last for a year.
Okay. How has it been supply chain wise during COVID? I imagine that has been a unique challenge. I know in Crazy. Other CPG industries, that's been tough. So how has that been for you guys dealing with all that craziness?
Crazy. And I would like to say that we're in a unique situation from COVID, like it's never happened before, but I'm sure people that launched businesses right before the 2008 crash had their own set of difficulties, and there's always going to be something. But for us specifically, aluminum, there's a huge shortage of it, which is just so interesting that when you're in the consumer world, what we love about it is we literally can impact people's lives on a daily basis. I don't mean like we're not curing cancer, we're not doing God's work by any means. But what gets us excited is the fact that a lot of people let us know that they just feel better when they're drinking our product. We're getting rid of lactose. So if anything, it's something that lactose-free gets digested easier than some lactose, that's good enough. Maybe people are trying to decrease their sugar and they feel better when they're having less sugar. Use Slate for that. Awesome. But so it's cool to see that impact. What's also really interesting is the impact that what's going on in the world also has back on the consumer landscape. And so, for example, with COVID, there's kind of this, you know, progression of like, you can't leave your house or everybody's wearing masks and you can't go out to restaurants. So a huge source of revenue for restaurants and a big portion of like sodas and teas and chocolate milk or whatever is the hose of the restaurants. And it's all food service. So if all of food service goes away with these huge 5-gallon containers, people still want those products, but now they have to buy them as a single serve item. So all of the volume that was in these food service containers are now being moved into cans or bottles. And that puts a huge strain on the supply chain, especially when it happened just at the same time that the whole world is now focusing on getting rid of plastic. I know it's been around for a few years, but like LinkedIn banned plastic on their campus and like there's all these things around it. And so now there's also a shift of like Aquafina and Dasani going into cans instead of plastic and at the same time. So there's this huge conglomeration where they're just trying to add canning capacity as fast as they can around the world. And we've been very, very lucky that our partners have been very good to us so that we haven't run out of supply. So among every other thing that could potentially go wrong, which things do all the time, that was a large one that we were fortunately able to kind of navigate.
I work in the alcohol space, so I
am
very familiar with the can shortage going on.
Yep.
I want to talk a little bit. You mentioned your partner, Manny, and kind of how the two of you guys have come together and built this out. So what has that been like for you, you know, having a co-founder and working with somebody that, you know, obviously you didn't grow up with, but you know, you guys from the same background, a lot of the same interests, like how have you guys sort of tackled this together as a team and, you know, dividing and conquering amongst what you're doing and what you're working on?
Hate to say it, because he's gonna blush and he's gonna be all excited when he hears this. But I genuinely could not have done any of this without him, and I would hope he would say the same. But no, we talk a lot about how our goal someday is to be successful with Slate, and maybe we choose to do it again. But regardless, we do want to help other entrepreneurs and invest in other entrepreneurs. And to us, it would have to be a very unique occasion or a very unique entrepreneur for us to want to invest in a solo founder versus co-founders. The amount of work that we both do. I mean, we're both working, I don't even know, 160 hours a week, however many hours there are in a week. And to have two people constantly doing that, pushing the business forward, especially with our different skill sets, like I'm the least creative person on the planet. I can't draw a stick figure. And Manny is very good with brand creativity. He's, you know, ideas, all of the marketing, digital marketing, e-commerce, brand, website, everything. Like he can really own innovation. And I'm much more like sales focused and operations and finance focused. And so that just kind of, the marriage works well on that side. And it would be very, very challenging to not have that. And we got really lucky. Mm-hmm. I mean, you hear about co-founders having troubles and breaking up, and you hear about people having a hard time finding a co-founder. And for us, it was kind of just dumb luck that it's worked out really well. And I trust the guy with my life, and I know he does the same. And our finances are now all in together, and our families know each other, and you know, all that kind of good stuff. So we have no choice now.
How does that piece of it work with the finances? Like, you know, have you both individually poured money into the business? I know you've taken on investment too that I want to talk about, but like individually, financially, what have you, you know, kind of piled into this?
Yeah, so we both put money in. We thought it was important that we both put in capital. I mean, we needed it to help with the initial formulations and kind of get the business off the ground. But we also wanted to show potential investors and employees that we're doing everything we can here. And we've continued to do whatever it takes for the business, whether it's, you know, getting loans or, you know, putting up our personal liability for credit cards or whatever. You know, we're not necessarily those founders that you hear some stories about where they put up their house and they were $500,000 in debt and they were able to turn around. I hope we never get to that point. Mm-hmm. We were lucky enough to have some of our own capital as well as raise money pretty early on from investors that believed in us. And to us, not having the risk of all of those kind of like shark deals and large debt on our shoulders, we were willing to give up some equity in the company with these investors earlier on.
Got it. Okay. So I wanted to talk about this as well, but the process of raising money and raising capital. So from my understanding, there's been a couple separate kind of elements for you guys of pouring money into the business with, I think the first being Kickstarter. So I don't know if there was anything pre or post Kickstarter that you guys did, but you raised what, $50,000 through Kickstarter. So tell me about that process and like, you know, creating that, you know, that initial video, creating the excitement around Kickstarter. And what did that initial $50,000, and what does that go towards?
So I could do a whole nother podcast just on Kickstarter alone. And I couldn't highly recommend it enough. When I first brought it up to Manny, he was like, only non-legit businesses that need it go on Kickstarter. Like he was like, it's kind of kitschy and, you know, who knows, but they have over 1 million people going to their website every day. Like they get a ton of traffic. And for us, the way that I really make sure I let people know is it's not a fundraising platform. It can help you fund your first purchase order. It's a cash flow help, but by no means is it a way to fundraise, because people are pre-ordering your product and they're typically buying it for a discount or significant discount on what you're eventually going to sell it for. So you are going to get, for us, we had 1,100, 1,200 people, I think it was 1,200, of our most loyal fans, like people that still are buying the product, still are messaging us. Like we love our Kickstarter backers, and we got a ton of information. They were very willing to get feedback and tell us what they wanted and all that kind of good stuff, which was awesome. And so that, like for us, like it was a great launching off marketing stint for us. And also showed to investors and retailers and stuff that we weren't just saying people like the product. We had $50,000 worth of sales to show it. And, but you are, you know, I think net, we probably pretty much broke even on the product, but we were able to use that cash early on to help fund our initial production run to then give all of our Kickstarter backers the actual product itself.
Got it. So that's that initial, excuse me.
Okay.
That initial wave is like a pre-order kind of circumstance.
It's like a pre-order.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. And like for beverages, for like a lot of consumer goods, it's typically that way. For like movies and some other things like that, sometimes it's just, you know, you get a credit on there, like a screen credit or something like that. And And it's more of like a donation style, but you have to give them something in return. And for us, it was the actual tangible goods.
And who I imagine it was Manny, because he is the sort of the star of the show, but he was the creator of kind of the video
Oh yeah.
that
Oh,
was used there.
I take zero credit. It was Manny and actually my college roommate who does a lot of screenwriting, and he's worked for a couple of video producers and stuff. So the two of them kind of put their heads together and did that whole thing. And we used a local guy here in Boston, and we spent from like 4 p.m. to midnight just in a warehouse style photo shoot. And we just went take after take after take and until we got it. And it was a lot of fun.
I don't even know if you have a speaking role in there. I think you're just the sign
No, I'm
guy.
just the guy holding the signs. I did not want a speaking role. I've tried to be on video saying things, and it does not work well. I'm not a camera, front of the camera guy.
It's funny. So like tell me about this a little bit as well, because obviously in sales, you are constantly talking to people. You're making probably dozens of phone calls a day. And you're comfortable with that, but being on camera is a whole different
I
situation for you.
honestly, I don't know what it is. I like put me in front of a group of 50,000 people. Like, obviously, I'll be nervous. I'm a human being, but I love that. Like, put me in front of groups, talking, seminars, one-on-one conversations, pitch meetings, anything I'm comfortable with. For whatever reason, it's not that I'm uncomfortable. I just can't act natural. Like, I'm just the worst actor, and I can't explain it. I like. If I'm in a natural setting, like I'm fine. If it's like me trying to take a selfie video or like, it's awful. And something to work on.
There are thousands of actors that have even said this, but they said there's nothing scarier than the little fisheye on a camera. That is
Yeah.
this there's this it's there's nothing scarier on planet Earth than that little thing right there.
So funny. I don't know what it is. And like I said, I'm not nervous. It's just when we've tried to do it, like Manny and I can't stop laughing. We're like, what the hell is wrong with you? Like it's, I don't know.
And were there nerves when you went on to Shark Tank?
Oh yeah. Manny and I have talked about this too, where, like I said, we're pretty comfortable speaking in front of people, and we're very lucky to both have kind of outward personalities. We're both very, comfortable doing sales, raising money, talking to people, things like that. Shark Tank was probably the most nervous either of us have ever been, and our legs were shaking before we're going in there. Like there's pressure, and one of the producers even told us that somebody was standing with their legs locked out, and after I can't remember how long, actually passed out
Really?
from locking their legs and not getting enough blood flow in their body right before we went out there. So we're like, that's in the back of our minds. Like, all right, we got to make sure we bend our knees when we're out there. And but it was honestly a huge bucket list item, and it was really, really cool to be out there.
How far after the Kickstarter kind of launches and you raise that money, did Shark Tank come into play?
They reached out to us within 2 months, maybe a month of Kickstarter launching,
Got it. Okay.
and it was a few months later.
So
And
they found you on Kickstarter and were like,
yep,
you guys would be good for
exactly.
this. Yeah.
The casting producer is like, the video is hilarious. You guys should come to our show. And then from filming to airing, it aired over a year later. So a lot, and some people are calling us like, what the hell? You didn't tell them you're in Whole Foods and all these retailers and your online stores are crushing it. We're like, guys, it was a year ago. Like, it's
Yeah.
okay. Like, we're okay. But oh man, my grandmother and grandfather will call me every other week to be like, you should call Mark Cuban and tell him how you guys are doing. I'm like, I don't think Mark cares, but I appreciate it.
I have heard Mark Cuban is fairly responsive to emails and DMs. So maybe you just check
You
in and
never
follow
know.
up on him.
I have, he was a great guy. He had a lot of, they cut an hour-long thing down to 7 minutes, and they kind of cut it together how they wanted to. But there was a lot of really good conversation. I have a ton of respect for all of them. They were all really good people, which was cool to see, because obviously sometimes you just see what they make for television, and there's a lot of really good conversation in there.
And what did that do for the business once that finally airs and you have the backing of or not the backing, but the exposure of being
Of
on Shark
course.
Tank? Like, what did that do
It's
for sales?
awesome. I mean, sales for us, the biggest value it brought was kind of a stamp of validity and awareness for the brand for our retail partners. Being able to say, like, hey, we've already been in front of 5 million people around the country helped our early retail partners get over the hurdle of like, our consumers aren't going to know what the hell Slate is. And so if we can continually kind of promote ourselves, and then in some of our geo-targeted social media ads and things like that, can we show, you know, as seen on Shark Tank and things like that, that immediately to the consumer is like, oh yeah, I kind of remember that. They might be more willing to try it. Mm-hmm. So that was the biggest help. You know, we weren't one of those brands that the day after did $10 million in sales kind of thing. There absolutely is a bump from sales for sure. But the biggest thing was just kind of the comfortability retailers had once they knew that consumers knew who we were.
Yep. Okay. I'm bouncing around a little bit here, but so, you know, you have your Kickstarter, you know, you raise your money with Kickstarter, you have the sort of Shark Tank reaches out experience. And at that point there, you know, there's some lag time between that launching, obviously, but what are, I like to do this, like explain it to me like I'm five.
Yeah,
on this show. That's my segment that I have. But like, so yeah. You know, you raise some of this initial money. What is that going towards exactly? And like, how are you deciding what that, you know, are we putting this into marketing? Are we putting this into, you know, bringing down our supply chain? Like, how is that being decided? Is that you who's sort of running point on that? Like, who is who's playing with the money there?
Yeah. We have this hilarious Excel document that we called expense roadmap. And literally we had line items of like a production run is going to cost us X amount. Testing Facebook and Instagram ads, we're going to put a $10,000 budget against that or whatever it was. Swag to be able to give to people is $1,000. Like we just literally built this and then we mm-hmm. broke it down month by month. And versus like a true financial model, this goofy little Excel was super easy to use for us. We didn't need a formal model. And, you know, we could do the projections and all that kind of crap. But like at the time, it was just like, how much money do we need to get this thing done? And, you know, early stage investors, especially that early where it's really just an idea. Numbers are great. But in the history of all startups, nobody's ever given a model that they're like, oh, well, you know, we're only going to do $1,000 in our first week. And then we might lose money here. It's all like this huge curve of like, we're going to grow so fast. We're going to have huge profits. And like, it's all like whatever, you know. So for us, it was more like, here's what we're actually going to spend, and you know, our goal for the first year is going to be to do X amount in sales, and here's how we plan on getting there. If we hit it, great. If not, like we'll have a reason why. But it was much more about they want to invest in who we are and betting on the fact that we're going to figure it out no matter what. A lot of the most successful brands and companies in general never started as what they initially thought, and you know, we're kind of paving our way still of who we are. But, you know, a lot of that initial money just went towards manufacturing was a big one. Mm-hmm. And for us knowing that we had a unique circumstance where we work with a large manufacturer. So our production runs are pretty large. And so even though we have a long shelf life, one production run, we couldn't just sell it online. Our marketing budget wasn't big enough to put out social ads and all that kind of stuff. So we needed retail partners. Mm-hmm. And so I was also really lucky about Kickstarter is that Whole Foods actually reached out to us from our Kickstarter as well.
That's cool.
So besides all of the initial marketing and all the great things, two great things from Kickstarter, Shark Tank and Whole Foods. It's very rare. Again, dumb luck. But as my dad says, the harder you work, the luckier you get. And so just by being in more places, we got those opportunities kind of cast upon us. Went in, had to do all the sales pitches and all that kind of stuff. It just helped open the door. And so when we launched with about 300 doors, about four retailers. So Whole Foods, Harris Teeter, Central Market, and Roach Brothers. Some of those names, many of you probably have never heard of. Boston area, Roach Brothers. I think mm-hmm. most people have heard of Whole Foods. Harris Teeter is owned by Kroger, biggest grocery store in the country. And Central Market, for any of you Texans, is owned by HEB, which is the big store down there. So that was our initial launch to help drive that initial demand. And so building all the product up for that was really the main use of funds. And then some of the initial marketing and stuff like that. And then we made our first hire locally here as well. That started with us when we launched. So it was the three of us and a lot of chocolate milk.
That's amazing. I just returned from a 12, 13 day tour of like the Southern United States where I did market visits in each one of these things. And as you know,
nice.
I was going into large format stores. So I got to see a Kroger, I saw an HEB, I saw, you know, a number of different, Albertson Safeway. I was seeing all these different
things I had no idea existed like before 2 years ago.
Yeah. Like how much have you just like ingrained yourself in the grocery store world?
you cut my veins open, chocolate milk comes out of it. Like it's from the day we started that, those 2 years, a lot of people are like, what the hell did you do for 2 years of like the idea to launching? And it was literally, I mean, first of all, it was hard to go quicker because we had to get the manufacturing and the R&D and all that kind of stuff. It's super challenging. But during that time, like anytime we had a down moment, I mean, we were talking to so many people that we wanted to always be the no more than anyone else. That's definitely not the case. And we're still learning every day, but we would try. And so anything we can learn about milk and processing and manufacturing and who manufactures what and revenues of different companies and what multiples they're getting on those revenues and how grocery stores work and the leadership of the grocery store, like literally anything. And still all day, every day, we're constantly talking to folks. And a lot of my, I don't think it's necessarily my girlfriend's favorite thing, but a lot of the times after work, I'm talking to other entrepreneurs, I'm talking to our manufacturing partners or whatever, and just learning and talking about what's going on and what's working for us and what's working for them. And it's cool. The CPG world is pretty small, like I'm sure a lot of industries are, and people genuinely are just trying to help each other. And that's been really cool to see, especially some like what some people would consider direct competitors. People are pretty friendly.
Yeah. What's like the most surprising thing that you've learned throughout your, you know, two and a half years, 3 years at this point of doing this? Is there one or two things that stands out that you're like, holy shit, like had no idea this was how X happened?
So many things. I think what's really, one of the things that's really interesting is the whole dairy industry. The government is very intertwined into the dairy industry. They regulate the prices of milk as a commodity. And there's a lot of things that made sense like 150 years ago, whenever it was first invented. And now it makes a little bit less sense. But it's just so interesting to see like the whole world of milk is such a different beast than what we were expecting with the different groups and regulations and marketing groups. Like the people that made the Got Milk campaign was just a big marketing group. It wasn't actually like a company or whatever. And there's all these really interesting things about dairy that we just didn't know until we're now kind of in this world now, which I thought was really, really cool. Also, this is just like classic kid growing up in the Northeast, right outside Boston. Like I know it's a very, 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 very small group of individuals, but sometimes you just forget how large the brands of like Coke and Pepsi, like how many people still drink like soda. And like nothing against it, like at all. I just, when you're walking around Boston, you don't see anybody walking around with soda and at restaurants. And I just like, it's so crazy when you go into all these grocery stores and just aisles and aisles and aisles and massive mountains of these kind of classic soda companies, which I know are losing market share by the day. But it's just so crazy to see.
Yeah. Like as the no sugar wave, I think like we're still very much in like the infancy of the beverage space with like no sugar. Obviously you guys are doing it, but like, you know, seltzers with like other alternative beverages, like we're just kind of kicking off of, you know, moving away from, you know, some of these like sugar heavy drinks.
And we're, and you know, for better or for worse, like we're kind of in a bubble. Like the coasts are very much like, everybody in the world, quote unquote, drinks White Claw. All of the influencers are drinking it. Everybody at the beach is drinking it and everything. But, you know, most of the time, those are people that are on the coast. And what's really important, especially to us, and what our current biggest investor gets excited about for Slate is that what he calls Americana, like chocolate milk. Everybody in the world knows what that is. We're not a reishi mushroom, lemon zest, you know, whatever, like people that live in Boston, LA, Wichita, Kansas, Ohio, Florida, no matter where you are in the country, people understand what chocolate milk is. And so for us, we're hoping that this is a product that can translate well to all communities and isn't necessarily like exclusive of basically center of the country or folks that don't live in Boston, New York, or LA.
And how have you guys thought about, or how has your target sort of shown itself so far, you know, in the limited time that you've been on shelves? Obviously, you know, a Whole Foods is different than a Kroger, than is different than even just the consumers who are walking into that store. So how has your target like kind of shown itself to you guys?
I would say that we very specifically have tried to be an all-inclusive brand. We're not gender specific. We're not age specific. We're not kind of wealth specific. You know, we really try to enable anyone and everyone to be able to buy Slate. And with our simplistic branding, that was the goal as well. And it's something we think RxBar did really well, where they didn't say they were only for an athlete. They weren't only for men. They weren't only for somebody who makes over 100 grand a year. Like, they are almonds, dates, whatever, and no BS. Like, we love that. And so for us too, it's like, you can drink Slate whenever you want. You want to replace a meal with it? You want it for breakfast? You want it for the snack? You want it as a post-workout? Like, have it whenever you want. And kind of the audience that we've really, the main audience for us, it slightly skews a little bit more male because it is chocolate milk, and things with high protein and chocolate milk specifically just tends to skew a little bit more male, but we're pretty close to gender neutral. And then we do skew towards folks that, whether they're fitness, they're more, whether they're into fitness or just like healthy minded people. So folks that are just trying to eat a little bit healthier, you know, they're not necessarily going on a strict keto diet for 6 months, but they just want to try to incorporate things that are a little bit healthier. And then people that we call active, like if somebody takes the stairs every single day instead of the elevator, because that's the steps they get that day, like they can have a Slate. Are they going to drink a Muscle Milk? No, because they're not benching 500 pounds. But we want to be for somebody that's taking the stairs instead of the elevator, that's trying to go to spin class twice a week, does push-ups before the shower. Like that's kind of like that audience that we've honed in on. But we've seen really good audiences with like young moms for their kids. And then you get anyone and everyone with all shapes, sizes, genders, everything in between. We've gotten photos of from friends and family and investors of people that they thought weren't are necessarily a target demo of ours, carrying two cases of Slate out of the grocery store. And like those kinds of things are really cool.
What's like the breakdown right now, at least for you guys, of e-com, like selling on your own store, and you know what you're selling at retail?
So with COVID, we really were in about 300 stores last year. We ended last year still under 1,000 stores. So we were still our retail landscape was pretty small, especially with COVID. Just not we weren't necessarily going to be getting into more stores during when COVID was first happening because they couldn't even keep the shelves stocked with their current items. And so last year, especially with people being home, we had a really strong e-commerce business. And allowed people to basically enable and come into subscription. So last year, e-commerce was actually more of our business than our retail side, by a decent amount, not crazy. It was pretty close to 50-50. And then just with the growth of retail for us, you know, we're in over 3,000 stores now. And we're getting a lot of really awesome partners like Publix and Wegmans and Market Basket and more divisions of Whole Foods and Ahold divisions and all these different names that we've seen a lot of early growth in has really started to take over. And so, you know, long term, we hear a lot of beverages kind of hone into like the 70 to 90% retail and then like 10 to 30% e-commerce world. We'll probably end up in there as well. You know, 80-20 seems to be what a lot of beverages like us land at, but if we can have more e-commerce business, then we'll take it.
As you've evolved and obviously gotten into more of these stores, I imagine more, you know, more revenue is pouring in. How have you guys built out a team around you? I assume it's not just you anymore, you know, going around to thousands of grocery stores selling this in. So how have you like built this out since hiring that first person at launch?
Hardest thing to do is good people. And we've interviewed so many, and so many of them were incredible people. And for us, having such a small company and such small dollars, and how everybody, every single day, the way we phrase it is they are running their own business. We don't have time to be managers, and we suck at managing. I definitely am. Manny and I have much more of like a leadership and lead by example mentality versus a management mentality. But you do need managers on teams, and so we, you know, we're still learning. We're still getting better at it. But for us, every single person that joined has joined Slate today really is an entrepreneur within themselves, and they've really taken on a lot of initiative where we don't have to really handhold or babysit. And as the business has grown, we've needed to institute a few layers of management. Which those people are better managers than I could ever hope to be, and they've been crushing it. So since we launched, we had one person, as I mentioned, in 2019. In 2020, we added maybe four or five more. And then in the last like 6 months, I think we've added like 20 people. So we have 25 full-timers now. A couple of part-timers, and it's just been crazy. So our Our team is about 50% people in the field doing very similar to what you did. They're going into the stores, building relationships. We can't demo right now, so trying to get additional placements in the stores, building displays, giving coupons to customers, any way that we can help drive trial and awareness about Slate really is part of our strategy. And so about half of that 25 person team are actually out in the field.
Okay. All right. So I imagine that's like changed your world a little bit. Like
Oh yeah.
how much, obviously in you're starting something, it's just you. It is your, what's
Yeah.
your, it's your idea. I'm doing this thing. This is what we're doing. Like,
Oh, we suck at it. Oh, we're so bad
how is
at
the
giving away
delegation
responsibility.
of
Oh my
things?
God. I'm so bad at delegating. It's unbelievable. And if you ask, like, so we have three director level people, and then everybody else is kind of, nobody manages anybody. Everybody's it's a very flat organization. But our three directors that Manny and I work the closest with, I'm sure they'll be the first people to tell you that it's really, really hard to delegate things. And we're still learning, we're still getting better at it. And they've I think we've all found a system that works for us. But it's your baby, and you want to a lot of the early relationships for the first year or two was people just believing in Manny and myself. And it was them just betting on us and the goodwill of the relationship that we had built. And our everyone we've hired is smarter than us, and everyone that we've hired can equally build those relationships. But it's when you have a lot, we're all in on it, and it's definitely something that we're continuing to improve upon. But just getting good people on the team makes it a hell of a lot easier. And there are, as I mentioned, just born managers on our team that have really allowed us to have a week go by and being like, wow, I didn't like they just did all that, and I had no idea any of that was happening, and it got done. And there's a lot of things I'm sure I have no idea is going on right now that people are crushing every single day. I know there's a lot of things going on, but as long as they, the biggest thing for Manny and I that I think is if as we delegate more, when problems come up, being looped into those problems and so that we can help where we can, that's kind of the give and take that we're kind of instituting in our company is we'll give you as much responsibility as you want, do your thing. You need us, come get us. And don't be afraid to make mistakes because we have made a ton of them.
I have this question always for people. What is the biggest fuck up that has happened so far? Is there one? I'm sure there's thousands, but like, does any stand out in particular?
Oh man, so many. I also use this as an interview question that I also stole from my dad, who said that he would interview a lot of folks that had a ton of experience, and they'd be like, oh, "I don't really make mistakes," and immediately they were kind of disqualified
Oh,
for the interview process. Biggest mistake we've made. We made a lot of them. I mean, I think a good lesson that we learned early on was we went after some shiny objects. We went after service providers that were kind of best in class, very expensive, had all these great accolades. And instead of kind of being more scrappy, we decided to throw money at problems early on because we had raised a little bit early, and we definitely wasted some money on some different services that ended up not moving the needle for us. And that was a big learning experience for us, and it really hurt because it was our personal money at the time. But in the grand scheme of things, it's a lot less money to learn that lesson than it would be now. So that is like a big one, and that was kind of goes into whenever we haven't gone with our gut, we've had the worst things happen. That is, it's not really quantifiable, and it's a weird thing to say out loud, but between the two of us, usually we have a pretty good gut on things. And whenever we've gone against it, things have gone wrong. I mean, we've had truckloads of product needing to be pulled off the road at 2 a.m. to make sure, something was labeled correctly or stickered properly. We've had ingredients not showing up until, days before production that we had to beg, cheat, and steal from other competitors to make sure we got those ingredients in time. I mean, there's so many, but yeah, I would say going against our gut was the worst, and early on spending too much money in places we didn't have to, it is definitely up there.
Okay, I like those. Where do you see what is like the 1, 5, 10, 20-year plan? Like, where do you see this business going? Where do you want to take it? Does that roadmap exist for you guys? Or are you kind of like building the plane as you're flying it, sort of?
I mean, both. I mean, constantly have to be doing both, right? As soon as you have an investor in there, their question is, how am I going to get a return? It's not fair to them. It's not fair to you. And so most food and beverage companies don't end up becoming Coke or Pepsi. A lot of them get acquired by the bigger companies. And there are more and more examples now of companies trying to IPO or becoming like Chobani, who was private for a very long time. And now they're considering IPO now. But, you know, I think for us, what gets us excited about Slate is compared to maybe something else is that we aren't a dairy brand, but dairy is our main ingredient. And the way we talk about it is like Peloton, the idea of Peloton, this like fitness athleisure style brand, meeting like a Chobani. It's a very craft, better for you dairy brand where it's not just yogurt, but it's everything else. Kind of merging those two together with like bringing a fitness angle to a category of dairy that brings people back to it gets us excited. And so if we were a apple juice company, there's only so many things you can do with apple juice. And there are only a certain amount of flavors you can do, but what gets us excited about dairy is, like I said, is potentially becoming the next Chobani. That's a huge goal for way down the road. And whether it's Manny and I doing it or somebody who buys us or, you know, long-term we'll see, but, you know, being able to go into all other areas and giving all other areas of dairy a clean slate, reducing sugar in people's diets, increasing protein, making sure the products are lactose free. Manny and I both consume a ton of dairy even before this. You know, we both have cottage cheese before we go to bed. We both love ice cream and frozen yogurt. You know, I have a Chobani every morning, for breakfast, you know, and usually two slates a day, but it's, the whole category is exciting.
And
then long-term, like I said before, invest in other companies, mentor other founders, whatever we can do to help. I mean, the only reason why we're where we're at now is from all of the people that have believed in us, all of the founders that have given us help, all of our investors that were previous founders that like, were like, here's all the things I did wrong. Here's all the things I do differently. You know, we can only hope to do that kind of stuff. And, and then maybe way down the road, teach at a college, you know, maybe do some stuff like that. Like I had a really interesting mix of professors of folks that didn't work in business since before the internet was invented, which like, I'm sorry, but that doesn't help anybody.
Right. Doesn't translate.
Yeah. And then I had a couple of professors that were incredible and just came out of the industry. And so for me to try to help, especially like entrepreneurship and education in that way, and then kind of the college realm or maybe even high school realm long-term is interesting to me. I don't know if I'll do it, but I'm definitely interested in it.
Okay. And then from a product standpoint, like, is there anything that excites you innovation wise? I know you guys have your like core, I think three styles right now.
Yep.
Like, is there anything immediately on the horizon, or are you sort of focused on like, let's nail what we've got right now and then start to build out iterations?
The hardest thing in the world to not want to just keep innovating. I mean, there's so many ideas and so much innovation that we have that we really want to bring to life. We did win a competition in New York that supports agriculture and dairy in upstate New York. And part of that competition was bringing a new item to market. So at the beginning of next year, we will be venturing into the world of vanilla.
Okay.
So we'll have a non-caffeinated vanilla flavor and then a caffeinated vanilla flavor. So to all those folks who don't like chocolate or allergic to chocolate, whatever, vanilla milk is not regular old white milk. It actually is flavored like vanilla ice cream. Think about it that way, like a vanilla protein shake. And then we'll have the coffee or caffeinated version as well. So that is kind of the most immediate thing that we're super excited for. Give people a change of pace, and we'll have five core SKUs at least, if not six or seven. And then some other really exciting innovation that we have planned for kind of mid to late next year that we're still a little too early to start talking about now, but our goal is by the beginning of next year to start kind of putting the word out there.
That's exciting. That is exciting.
Yeah.
I'll be very curious to see how you guys can market vanilla milk to show it in a glass or show it, you know, so that people are like, this is not just your ordinary.
This is not just white milk. Yeah. And we'll get creative. You know, we might call it like, you know, French vanilla or, you know, it won't be in a, you know, gallon container. Like it'll be next to our other items, and it will definitely happen sometimes, but the more we can educate, and I mean, milk in a can, first of all, like already people are like, what the hell, like milk in a can? And so there's already a lot of obstacles. So hopefully that's just one that they just, you know, kind of pass by. But the uniqueness of our product has been what's actually helped drive a lot of trials. So hopefully the vanilla does as well.
Okay, cool. All right, I got a couple of rapid fire questions for you to kind of close things out here. You get a billboard in Times Square. You can put anything you want on it. What are you putting on it? What does it say? It could be personal. It could be about Slate. It could be anything, but you get a billboard in Times Square. What are you putting on there?
See, this is where Manny would have the perfect answer, and I just don't have one. So I would put a shot, some, I would want it to be funny. I wouldn't want, like, my gut initially went to a huge picture of a can of Slate, and it said chocolate milk built better, because that's what we use on a lot of our signage. So that like gut reaction got into my head. We have to do it for tomorrow. That's what I would do.
Okay.
But I would rely on Manny and his brother and my college roommate to come up with something really witty around kind of poking fun and something good about and including Slate.
Okay. All right. I like that. And then my other, if you get one person, could be a celebrity, could be an athlete, could be a musician, could be anybody to drink Slate, to endorse it, to be in your commercials. Who are you picking for that?
Manny and I've talked about this a lot, and we would go right now that the top two or top three contenders before they signed with other people. We love Simone Biles, everything she stands for, the athlete of who she is, the mental health, like everything we think is incredible. She does apparently is sponsored by Core Power, one of our competitors. So that's a huge bummer, but she was a big one that we really, really like. The other two that we talk about a lot are Michael B. Jordan and Chris Hemsworth. Okay. And, you know, you got Thor, you got Creed, you got, you know, Black Panther movies. And so for us, having somebody that is very fitness forward versus like a bodybuilder. Mm-hmm. And there's so many athletes that we would love to have and are great additions, and I would never say no to it. But we didn't want to pigeonhole ourselves as something that's only for professional athletes. Mm-hmm. What those three people stand for to us is much more like fitness. And from as far as I'm concerned right now, there could be things on Google I don't know about. They seem to be people that stand for really positive things. And that's what Slate's really all about.
Has there been any celebrity or like notable drinkers that you've seen that you're like, oh shit, this person's drinking my product?
We've had more than I can even think of. It's been amazing. And we have a head of partnerships, our first employee, who is constantly seeding product out to people, and people just authentically love it and post about it. And so we haven't had to pay for it, which is amazing. I mean, without us sending him anything, Rob Gronkowski was just going to Whole Foods and buying it because he just loved the product. And him and his brothers have been awesome. They're fans of the product. A lot of the different quarterbacks like Ben Roethlisberger and people there and kind of like the football world, Kendrick Bourne is now on the Pats, Hunter Henry on the Pats. So a lot of those guys for football, basketball, you know, a lot of the Celtics, some of the lesser known, like the Anthony Melton for the Grizzlies and Pat Connaughton for the Bucks and like those guys. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think if there's like any Ashley Hatch, who's a professional soccer player, some MMA fighters. Conor McGregor loves chocolate milk, so had some there. Like it's you know, it's cool. It's definitely, it's a good piece of validation that a lot of athletes do recover with chocolate milk. Mm-hmm. But you know, for us, it's all about creating awareness around the brand. You know, giving Kim Kardashian a can of Slate and paying her $1 million to post on her Instagram to us, like, just doesn't feel authentic. Mm-hmm. And so we really just want to be having the product in the hands of people that authentically love it.
Okay. I love that. That's amazing. And then maybe my last two questions. First one, like at some point, do you guys all just walk, like, are your profile pictures like with milk mustaches? Like, are we bringing back the Got Milk commercials? I guess is my question.
The Got Milk commercials are back. As of about a month ago, if you look,
okay,
not through Slate, but through the same organization. And so that's a massive conglomerate with millions of dollars that would bury us in a lawsuit. So our goal is to eventually partner up with them and try to somehow. But if you look at all of the commercials ever, there's no brands associated with it. Mm-hmm. So for us, we see that as a huge plus of people that are promoting dairy as a whole and kind of taking away the, some of the negative things around milk.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, maybe we get creative with it in the future. But at this point, I think the threat of a lawsuit is too, hits too close to home to want to deal with it.
Fair. Fair enough. And then my last question, I sign off every show with the sign off of stay weird. So I'll ask you, Josh, what makes you weird?
What makes you weird? Oh, I mean, I sing to my cats when I'm home with my girlfriend. I think that's probably something very strange. I also love Bruce Springsteen. I've been to 10 shows. My dad's been to 50 of them. I am always known as like the dad in the group because I just like, I love old music and I'd rather talk about business than really anything else. But I would say the cats one is probably the weirdest thing that nobody's ever seen me do, but my girlfriend pretty much witnesses it every day.
All right.
And so, yeah.
Okay. There you go. I like that. And then if people want to find you, if they want to support Slate, if they want to buy it, they want to try the product, where can people listening to this find Slate in stores or online?
Yeah. So always our website, www.slatemilk.com, SLATEMILK.com. That is, you can order directly from there. You can also see our product locator on there. So you can see all of the stores that we're in. We're in a lot of the major stores on the East Coast. We're still kind of building out center of the country and West Coast. We focus more so on the East Coast. So definitely anywhere else. I would highly encourage you to check the product locator. If you can't find it, definitely message us.
But it ships to the West Coast.
But it ships everywhere. It ships everywhere on the West Coast. It even ships to Canada and Hawaii and Alaska. I think shipping's like $50 or $100. But if you love it, some people are buying it. But within the continental US, all shipping is free and we ship all 48 states, get it in a couple of days. And as of, I believe this week, we are now live on Amazon as well. So if you want to head on to Amazon and do that, that is another way you can buy the product.
Wow. All right. All right, cool. Well, thank you, Josh. This was awesome. That's a wrap.
Nice. Thanks for having me, dude. It was great.
A wrap on this week's episode of Destination Different. Huge thank you to Josh for coming on this week's show. I mean, massive Kickstarter campaign, check. Going on Shark Tank, check. Mark Cuban spitting out your product on national TV, check. Appearing in the Wall Street Journal, check. Placement in Whole Foods, Roche Brothers, all these massive, massive retailers, Amazon now. Check, 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 check. So exciting to hear kind of what Slate is doing, what they're building. I'm very excited. These guys, Slate, just seems to have the makeup of a company that is going to be a massive, massive player in the beverage space someday. So excited to keep hearing, keep seeing them build it out and fascinated to hear their story of how it's grown to where it is today. So thank you to Josh for coming on this week's show. Again, as we mentioned at the end here, but we will get it linked up in the description of the episode where you can follow Slate, where you can buy Slate at slatemilk.com. So make sure you go and check them out over there if you're looking to get your hands on some chocolate milk. That is all we got for this week. We are quickly approaching episode 100 of the Destination Different podcast. I'm very excited. I'm very excited. I'm actively pursuing a big name guest to be named later to come on for episode 100. I figure if I just keep promising it, if I just keep talking about it on these airwaves, that eventually it has to happen. So stay tuned for that. I am pushing towards a monumental guest for episode 100. We'll be back again next week, next Wednesday, with another episode of Destination Different. Thank you, thank you, thank you, as always, to everybody who listens, who rates, who subscribes, who leaves reviews. It means a lot to me that nearly 2 years later of doing this podcast and the number of people who are listening, sending me kind messages, just continues to grow. And it seems like the quality of these guests just keeps getting better and better and better right along with it. So we'll be back again next week with another episode of Destination Different. Until then, stay weird.
I had a dream. You gave me superpowers. We fell in love for just a couple hours. I can't tell the difference between what's fake and what's been missing. Often I'm misunderstood, so I'm looking for a better me. This is your love song, baby.